You're 3,000 feet above the trees in a hot air balloon. Your significant other gets down on one knee and pulls out a box containing a ring. You realize that this is the magic moment you've been looking forward to, because there's never been a better time to test drive the 2019 CLA Coupe at your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer. With its sleek silhouette, unrivaled performance and technology, the CLA is your dream ride. Visit mbusa.com/CLA to learn more. Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing.
They're gonna kill the love of my life.
Jason!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal truck, bring it to me. Then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain for love.
Collide. Now playing. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, for being the highest life form on the planet, we are pretty big dumbasses. For example, there was this huge rainstorm, and a woman, a friend of a friend from Los Angeles, was up in San Francisco. She had a flight back to L.A., but she was terrified of getting on a plane in the rain, so she threw away her ticket, she rented a car, and she drove 10 hours home in a horrible storm. This, of course, is the height of dumbassery, because statistically, and I could be slightly off on this, but your risk of dying in a plane crash is reportedly 1 in 60 million. But there's a pretty substantial risk of dying in a car crash, reportedly 1 in 100. So this woman cost herself time, peace of mind, and money, and made herself a lot less safe by doing it. The truth is, though, if we all look closely at our own lives, we all do really dumb things that are not warranted by the facts. This is what we're going to try to correct, at least a little bit tonight. My guest tonight, Dr. Dylan Evans, will try to help you change this. He's written a really great book on risk intelligence, Risk Intelligence, How to Live with Uncertainty. So learning to be more comfortable with uncertainty is just one of the ways you can increase your ability to make wise decisions, fact-based decisions, instead of the superstition and ignorance-based ones that are often the defaults that our brain pushes us toward. So stick with us tonight. Dylan Evans will help you and all of us learn how to be less idiotic and self-defeating in the way we do business, act in our relationships, and live our lives. So hello, Dylan.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm so glad you're here. I love your book. So let's start with talking about how risk intelligence and intelligence are two different things. So tell us, what is risk intelligence?
Well, risk intelligence is the ability to estimate probabilities. Now, that might sound a bit abstract, a bit esoteric, but think about it a bit more, and we actually do it all the time every day. When we have to go out, we might think, well, what's the chance of it raining? If it's a high chance of it raining, we'll take an umbrella or we'll take an overcoat. What's the chance that we will get this job interview that we've asked for? What's the chance that house prices might go down? You know, these are all kind of decisions ranging from the very small to the very large, that where we have to kind of figure out how likely something is to happen.
Now, we're not very good at this. You talk about how people tend to overestimate their chances at winning the lottery while underestimating the probability that they will get divorced.
Right. Well, there's a whole bunch of different biases that we all have to overcome if we want to estimate probabilities better than we usually do, which is generally quite bad. And one of those biases is something that psychologists call optimism bias. That means that we tend to look at the future through rose-tinted spectacles. We think, okay, we know that 1 in 3 marriages, you know, in the States end in divorce, but what are the chances that I will get divorced? Nah, 1%, 2%. We know that my chances of winning the lottery are just the same as everyone else's. We know that I don't know anyone else who's won the lottery, but why is it that I keep buying lottery tickets? Because somehow I think that when it comes to me, I'm going to be luckier than everyone else.
And so this optimism bias, I guess we'll get back to that, how to overcome it, because I wanted to talk about a few of the things, you know, people, you say that at the heart of risk intelligence, you know, is the ability to gauge the limits of your own knowledge, to be cautious when you don't know much, and to be confident when you know a lot. But we're bad at this.
That's right, because actually there's kind of two sides to risk intelligence. On the one hand, there's a sort of side of risk intelligence that is concerned with the objective world outside us, external reality. How likely is it that this event is going to happen? This is something, you know, that's nothing to do with me, whether it rains or not today. But the other side of risk intelligence is a kind of inward-looking side. We have to figure out how much, if we're going to make an accurate prediction, we actually have to know how much we know about the subject. We have to gauge the limits of our own knowledge. We can make a much bolder statement about the future if we know a lot more about the relevant facts. If we're a weather forecaster, we can be more confident about what the weather will be like tomorrow than if we have no idea about the meteorology or anything like that. And on the other hand, if we really don't know that much, we have to admit that and be cautious. And so these two things come together, both a knowledge of reality and a kind of knowledge of how much we know, metacognition.
Yes, and we're going to get to that. I just wanted to get to the umbrella because you have a great example of that in the book. I love this, where you talk about, one of the ways to deal with this is to set a threshold where you trade off costs of a particular course of action. You'd have to ask yourself, okay, how much do I dislike getting wet versus how much do I dislike carrying an umbrella?
Right. Well, I mean, whenever we kind of, if people say, well, what's the point of risk intelligence? Let's say I get really good at it. Let's say I get really good at putting percentages on things. I can say there's a 30% chance it will rain tomorrow or a 20% chance. So what? How does that help us actually live our lives? How does that help us make decisions? And the reason people ask that question is that they're not used to using probabilities. When people make decisions, they just think, will it rain or not? They think in black or white. Yes or no terms. That's what I call the all or nothing fallacy. And part of risk intelligence is learning to think in shades of gray, let's say. I'm not talking about the novel here. It's thinking like, yeah, is it slightly, is it very improbable? Is it more probable? And so on. And once we do that, we have to use new ways of making decisions. So instead of just saying, well, if it's going to rain, I'm going to take my umbrella. If it's not going to rain, I'm not going to take it. But we know that really it's a question of probability. So then we have to say, well, how do I decide on the basis of a probability? One way is to set a threshold. So I'll say, well, I'll only take my umbrella if, let's say, there's a 50% chance of rain or more. And different people can set that threshold at different levels, depending on how much they dislike carrying an umbrella or how much they dislike getting wet. Or let's say you're thinking of asking someone out on a date. You know, you might say, well, before I'm going to ask that person out on a date, I want to be sure, I want to think about how likely is it that they will say yes. And maybe I will only actually summon up the courage and ask them out on a date if I think that there's at least, say, a 50% or a 60% chance or a 70% chance that they'll say yes. Again, how should I set that threshold? Well, it will depend on each person, how much they dislike being rejected, for example, and how desperate you are to go on a date.
Right, and actually you've probably heard of error management theory, because Marty Hazelton at UCLA came up with that, and that's really about mating, their error management theory, where they talk about the least costly mating error. And I love, you have a great calculation at the end of the book about asking an attractive classmate out, where you actually figure out the percentages, the probabilities, and you're big on this, on figuring out, instead of being loosey-goosey on the information and saying, oh, kind of this, kind of that, and sort of nailing it down to numbers and percentages.
Right. I'm not saying that, you know, we can be precise about these numbers. In a sense, that's kind of almost to get the whole thing completely wrong, because the whole point of putting things in numbers is not to seek after a a kind of false precision, but in order precisely to express our uncertainty, what we're using is the language of probability, in a sense, to just as a way of expressing more clearly how uncertain we are. So it's really a kind of way of forcing ourselves to be honest with ourselves about how much or little we know in any given situation. And that by forcing ourselves to think in these, put numbers on things, we maybe can make some progress and get a little bit better at operating in what I call the twilight zone. This is the zone in the area between perfect knowledge and complete ignorance. It's the place where we live most of our lives.
Yeah, and the uncertainty, we are really uncomfortable with that, and we like to nail things down even when we don't know, and that's a big problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, some people do, but there's also the opposite problem, which is some people really never like to nail things down at all. They have the opposite problem. So what you're talking about is ambiguity aversion, and another similar related thing is what we call the need for closure. That's when people demand an answer. Even a wrong answer is better than no answer at all. So these are the people who really just don't like uncertainty. They can't stand it. They'd rather just get any answer at all rather than remaining in a state of uncertainty. And the opposite problem, the other thing I was just talking about just now, is where people do the opposite. They put off an answer. They want to leave the question open for as long as possible. They want to sit on the fence. They demand more and more evidence, but no evidence is enough to ever make them commit themselves one way or the other. And I see risk intelligence as lying halfway between these two extremes. It's about having the right amount of confidence, of remaining uncertainty, being happy to remain in uncertainty when the information isn't there, but making up one's mind when the information is there.
And you have these fascinating tests, actually, when you measure, you know, how strongly that you feel the need for closure. And I'll read these. I love these. You say, agreeing with statements like these suggests a greater need for closure. I feel irritable when one person disagrees with what everyone else in the group believes. I need to change my plans at the last minute. Suggested a greater need for closure. It's annoying to listen to someone who can't seem to make up his or her mind. I'd rather know bad news than stay in a state of uncertainty. So those, you know, that's pretty interesting, those statements.
Yeah, and you can sort of get a feel for the kind of person who does display a high need for closure when you think about those statements. I'm sure we all maybe, you know, you'll know people like this. Maybe some of your listeners can identify these traits in themselves. And yeah, you know, that is sometimes, you know, in a leader, we kind of look for these traits sometimes. But the point is to have a balance. So to be able to tolerate a certain amount of ambiguity and uncertainty is important, because if not, we jump to premature conclusions and we miss important evidence and information that might point in the other direction.
Right. I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. This week's guest is behavioral scientist Dr. Dylan Evans, talking about risk intelligence, how to increase your ability to make wise decisions, fact-based decisions, instead of the superstition and ignorance-based ones that are often the default ones our brain pushes us toward. And his excellent book, which I recommend, is Risk Intelligence, How to Live with Uncertainty. I love later in the book you say that you hate when people say, I have no idea, because actually they do.
Right. I mean, to some extent, I guess, you know, this is just a figure of speech, but I think it's also often a kind of lazy way out when people say, look, I've got no idea, you know, about whether this is going to happen or not. If they actually were being honest, they might say, well, look, I do have an idea. I'm just kind of not comfortable talking about it. And then you could say, well, why not? So, but then sometimes it's a deliberate policy of evasion. I mean, there's some interesting remarks by James Fallows in his essays about the events leading up to the invasion of Iraq, where he talks about how the White House emphasized quite amazing message discipline, in which they actively refuse to speculate about, you know, how many troops would be necessary or what the cost of the war would be. They would say, you know, I have no idea. And of course they did. They had estimates, but they just didn't want to make them public.
What I love about your book is it gets into the nuances related to risk intelligence in both being open-minded and then also to have an idea when you think you have none. And you talk about leveraging your existing knowledge. And there was this great thing about the city of Chicago and figuring out, what was it? God,
how many piano tuners in Chicago?
How many what?
How many piano tuners in Chicago?
Right. And this seems like, how do you figure that out? But you said you actually can because you take what you know and you work from there.
Right. This was a question which the physicist Enrico Fermi used to ask his physics students, and they would all be really puzzled, like, what's our physics professor doing asking us a question about piano tuners in Chicago? But the whole point was that he was trying to encourage in his students an ability to make rough and ready estimates. You know, and this is useful. You know, we just don't, you know, we have the time or the money to make a very good measurement. Doesn't mean we can just have to throw up our hands and say, well, I have no idea. It means that we have to make do with less knowledge, but we can still make some educated guesses. And, you know, Fermi himself was well known for this. He once, apparently, when there was a test of the early atomic bomb, while everybody else was measuring the force of the bomb with incredible precision, with high-tech machinery, he just waited until the blast and then ripped up some paper and just dropped the pieces of paper just as the blast was coming and then looked how far the pieces of paper were blown back behind him and then worked out what the mass of the paper was on the back, you know, just estimated it, looked at how far they'd gone. On the basis of those two scraps of information, he was able to work out what the force of the atomic bomb was, and it turned out that his estimate was pretty close to what the high-tech machinery eventually told the, you know, it was within an order of magnitude. So, you know, it just shows what you can do with relatively little information if you're clever at linking what information you have together.
And you talk about that, bringing information in, but you also talk about remembering that we are biased creatures, and that you talked about your own, you have a certain political belief, but then you looked at the Iraq War and looked at the other side, and a lot of people don't do that.
Right. Well, this was, in the process of writing the book itself, as I was just explaining just now, I was reading some stuff about the Iraq War for various reasons, just because I think the intelligence failures that led up to that were very interesting cases of how people failed to exercise risk intelligence, even in the intelligence community, ironically enough. But while I was doing that, I realized that I was actually committing one of the big mistakes that I was accusing some other people of. In other words, I was only reading from about the Iraq War from one very narrow set of sources. You know, I was reading stuff from newspapers in the UK, because I'm British, and I was reading stuff mainly from liberal newspapers like The Guardian. So this is one very narrow perspective. So I thought, hey, this is, you know, I'm kind of a hypocrite here. I'm not practicing what I preach. So I deliberately set out to widen my sources. I read a lot of U.S. sources and sources from France and other countries around the world, European countries and Australia and so on. And then I also read from across the political spectrum, not just the sort of the liberal left, but the conservative right and Muslim ideas on it and everything. So, and then one day I was reading Donald Rumsfeld's memoirs. I think brilliant, kind of excellent views on risk intelligence there too, you know, in terms of unknown unknowns. But,
oh, I just have to stop you and quote this from the end of the book because I love this. And I know you probably lost your political left decoder ring for this, for quoting Donald Rumsfeld. But this great line, there are things we do not know we don't know. And I thought that was brilliant, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's much maligned, and in England, you know, people used to do on the radio, they used to have this sort of on BBC radio, they used to have this Donald Rumsfeld quote of the week, in which they would kind of take something he had said and just you know, repeat it and laugh at it as if it was the most idiotic thing in the world, which is a kind of easy, cheap shot to take. But in fact, some of these things that he said were really quite profound, including the unknown unknowns quote, which you know, he was obviously quite fond of because he used it in the title for his autobiography. But anyway, I was reading this, and a friend came around. He said, "Oh my, you know, what are you reading this for? This is Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, don't believe everything he says." And I said, "Well, no, of course I don't. But you know, nor do I discount it, or you know, immediately either. You know, I take it as a sort of there's some evidence there. How reliable different bits of that evidence are? Well, we've got to judge it, you know, each on a case by case basis. We don't believe it all naively, nor do we reject it all naively." So I think that, you know, that's the kind of attitude I think we have to take, read critically and read widely, and not live in these sort of increasingly narrow filter bubbles where we just exclude information that comes from any source that we vaguely disagree with.
Absolutely. And actually, I should do a station ID, and I'm going to do one, a little PSA for an organization I love and you know, and Advice Goddess Radio is a proud sponsor of Campus Civil Liberties Defenders, thefire.org. Please check out the great work they do to defend free of charge those on campus who get their civil liberties violated. And if you have a few dollars rolling around, please consider them sending them Fire's way. It's thefire.org. So, and I am talking with Dr. Dylan Evans. We're talking about his book, Risk Intelligence, How to Live with Uncertainty, which I recommend. So I love what you're saying, because I really try to do this. Now, it's a little easier for me because I'm a libertarian, independent. I hate both candidates running for different reasons. And so it's a little easier for me to pick from both sides because that sort of fits with my identity. But I think it's really important. I do it outside of politics, too, to realize that we're prone to have these biases. You know, and to look at the other side. I listen to Rush Limbaugh, and I listen to, you know, the radio. We have public radio here. I listen to both to hear both sides, because it's really important.
Absolutely, and I mean, I think, you know, this includes, you know, listening to people. And yeah, I think it's a real good discipline to listen to people you disagree with. But I mean, I think America, the problem with in America in particular at the moment, it's very polarized. And you know, there are some people who just listen to the conservative talk shows. There are some people who will never listen to them. Like, you know, when I was in the States a few months ago, I was telling a friend that I was watching Fox News, and he was horrified. You know, and I think, you know, then I was watching Glenn Beck or something, and he was even more horrified. And I was like, you know, but have you actually ever watched Glenn Beck? And he was like, "Well, I watched a few clips on YouTube, but you know, those are the clips that liberal friends of his had sent on YouTube because they were the bits that were easiest to make fun of Glenn Beck." So, in other words, all he'd seen of Glenn Beck was the bits that were filtered through his liberal friends. Now, that's not watching Glenn Beck, you know. And I mean, I'm not saying singling Glenn Beck out because he's some particularly great guy. Just, you know, it's an example of how people just refuse to even, you know, consider the possibility that someone who comes from another political point of view might occasionally be worth listening to, even if it's just to understand what the different point of view is.
Right. And there's too much of this, and I see it on Twitter and Facebook, because I have people left and right following me. It's like, Barack Obama's Adolf Hitler. No, Mitt Romney's Adolf Hitler. And probably Adolf Hitler wasn't even Adolf Hitler. You know, it's just crazy. And it really means that you're always going to like a guy. Maybe your guy does some evil thing, and you're still compelled to, you know, stick with him because he's your team, and that's really bad.
Yeah, but I think here we get to this sort of maybe some of the evolutionary basis for some of these biases, and, you know, and because people get sort of puzzled by all this irrationality, but in a sense, it's the other way around. What we've got to be really thankful for and appreciative of, and maybe pleasantly surprised by, is the fact that, you know, there's any rationality at all, given that we're descended, you know, from primates, chimpanzee-like creatures, and reason is a relatively new arrival on the scene. So we're still figuring out how to use this sort of primitive mind in ways that maybe is a slightly newer software than it originally came with.
I wanted to ask you, I think this is a good time maybe to ask you about heuristics, rules of thumb. Can you, I didn't mean to, if you were on another tangent, but I think that this
is... I think this is exactly the right point to talk about this, because heuristics, are quick and dirty rules of thumb, as you say, that cognitive shortcuts that we use when we're trying to figure out the answer to a question, but we don't have time or we don't have the inclination to spend a whole bunch of time figuring out what the real right answer is. So, for example, if we are asked to estimate how likely it is that how dangerous a plane journey is, for example, we might just try and remember, and we do this unconsciously, we don't even set out to do it deliberately, we just do it automatically. We tend to think, how easy is it to recall a plane crash? And we use the ease of recall as a kind of guide to how likely something is. If it's very easy to think of something, then we think that is a relatively frequent and relatively likely event. If it's really hard to think of some instance of, maybe a car crash or some other a horse racing accident, we can't really think of that very easily unless we're regular horse racing fans, maybe. So we think, well, that's really unlikely. Now, that is not a bad trick, but of course it doesn't always work. And so it can often lead us astray, especially when it comes to, because of the media, distort the kind of relationship between how likely something is and how easy it is to remember it, because they tend to report dramatic events, which are rare, but then once they're reported, they're really easy to remember, so we overestimate how likely they are. So, these heuristics, they our mind is full of them because evolution designed our mind to work in that way. It doesn't design our mind to make the perfect answer, just give good enough answers that get us by most of the time. And risk intelligence involves learning to be aware of these heuristics and their pitfalls and to be able, therefore, to take sort of corrective steps to figure out when maybe they're not leading us in the right direction.
And so it's very important to know these biases, and you write about a lot of them. One of them that you talked about a little bit is optimism bias, that we are prone to be biased in favor of believing the good and the fast that will, for example, finish a project really fast when we won't, and we never do.
Right. So this is a very well-known one, the planning fallacy, as Daniel Kahneman and his former colleague Amos Tversky, who unfortunately died before he could get the Nobel Prize, because Kahneman and Tversky should have both got the Nobel Prize for the work they did. But, of course, you can't give the Nobel Prize posthumously. But together they basically founded the study of heuristics and cognitive biases. And the planning fallacy was one of the first ones I think they identified. It's the tendency we all have to think that we'll manage to get a project done, faster than we always think, okay, we'll do it in 4 weeks, but it never takes 4 weeks. It always takes 5, 6, 7 weeks, but we never learn. Like, I've got a friend who, whenever we agree to meet, she comes around to pick me up, she's like, I'll be there in half an hour, but it's never half an hour. Always an hour. Basically, there's a formula I've worked out. Whatever time she says she'll come around, double it. But she's never learned. So this is kind of, I guess, optimism bias in another form.
Greg is Skyping me right now, right on. I always say I'll be ready. And, it's just always something today, my shirt and my skirt, it was just a different colored white, and I came out and I had to change it. But it's always something, and you think that, that's the thing that we can do is look at the past. You say to do that, And this is something I actually tell other writers and even really experienced ones who have come close to winning an Academy Award. They totally underestimate the amount of time it will take for somebody to read something they've said they've read. And I realized, okay, it's going to always be longer, probably three times longer, if not longer, or that it may be never. And you can't. You have to accept that as reality. And if you do, then you don't get so upset.
Yeah, and this is absolutely right. And funny, I mean, we catch ourselves making these mistakes all the time. So the question is, how can we learn from it? I mean, there's a similar phenomenon to the planning fallacy, which psychologists call the yes, damn fallacy. you look in your diary. Someone says, "What are you doing in 3 weeks' time? How about we go? We meet up. We go for a coffee, or we go for go to see a movie or something in 3 weeks' time." You look in your diary. 3 weeks' time. There's nothing. We haven't got much going on in that week. So, you know, it's not like this week, which is full. So you say, yeah, sure, let's give ourselves make an arrangement close to the time. You get to the time, what do you say? Damn. Because the diary is now as full as it was when 3 weeks ago you looked in your diary and this week was the full week. It's just, of course, the diary begins to fill up when you get close to the time. So, but we never take this into account. So we're always saying yes, damn.
Now, is the best way to benefit from history, from the fact we've done this 65 times before, to remember that? Or, I mean, I look at my own life. I just am always late when we're going someplace because I'm always changing my clothes. So.
Right, well, The best way, yeah, why don't we just take, how can we actually learn from this stuff? The most important way to learn, I guess, when it comes to risk intelligence, is to nail our colors to the mast and make predictions, make bold predictions, and in particular, get used to making probabilistic predictions. So we say, like, I think there's going to be a 40% chance that I'm going to be late. I'm going to have a 30% chance. And if we get used to doing this, We make a note of whether our predictions came true or not, whether we were late or not. We can then begin to measure our risk intelligence. And in the book and on my website, I kind of give a simple explanation about how people can do this. There's a spreadsheet that people can download for free where they can actually make their own predictions, begin to notice whether their predictions come true or not. And you can do this in every aspect of our lives. It could be making predictions about the American election. It could be making predictions about whether our kid is going to do their homework or not, whether we're going to get a promotion. You know, personal predictions about our daily life, and just getting used to making those predictions, thinking about why they were right or why they were wrong, and getting feedback and measuring our own risk intelligence.
I just wanted to ask you to give your website, and then Greg actually has a question he's going to ask.
Sure. The website is www.projectionpoint.com, and there's a free risk intelligence test there which everyone can take to get a rough idea of what's involved in making these predictions.
But I like this idea that you can train yourself as you do this, and as you fail or succeed, you can adjust that. And you're big on putting percentages on things, not just being loosey-goosey, as I said before, because then you can hone it down more. If it's just really late, sort of late, that's not very useful.
Right. And this is the reason why U.S. weather forecasters have great risk intelligence and British weather forecasters don't. It's not because the weather is any harder to predict in the UK. It's because American weather forecasters have been required since the 1960s to express their forecasts in terms of percentages. They'll say, it's a 30% chance of rainfall. It's a 40% chance. In Britain, they don't do that. They can be as vague as they like. They can say, oh, it's probably going to rain tomorrow.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, because of that, the American forecasters have been able to learn, and because when you make when you put numbers on things, you can measure it, you can get feedback, and so on, and therefore you can get better. If you don't, you can't learn.
I like your description of that because I just think of the weathercasters here as two brass with a head on top, but somebody behind the scenes is doing that forecasting, and it really does. They do say 70% chance of rain. So now, Greg. My boyfriend and producer is going to ask a question. Go ahead, Greg.
First of all, Dylan, did you see the time that Prince Charles did the weather?
I didn't see that, no.
It's on YouTube. It's hilarious. Basically, my question is this. You know, like, I spent my professional life trying to, you know, like, be, you know, perfect in a way. But, I mean, you know, just trying to, like, do the job, be on time, you know, be able to handle, you know, like, any commitment that I that I would make, you could take to the bank. That's what I'd like to think. But the people that I deal with, they're not bad people, but they'll tell me things like, you know, I'll call you tomorrow morning, no, you know, without fail, because we got this hot project going on. And then you call them back in the afternoon, and they say, oh, well, we had an emergency this morning.
Right.
And so that's, I don't know what the question is, but that's the stuff to throw into the blender. If you don't
mind. I think the way to deal with that is you've got to assign a kind of credibility index to each person that you speak to. You know, so how likely is it that they are really going to call you back? How much trust should you put in each person when they make a promise to you? If one person says, I'll call you back tomorrow, maybe they're really trustworthy. Maybe you have they said that to me. That means there's a 90% that person really will call me back. Someone else says it, you think, yeah, right, there's 10% chance that they really will do that. So we can use this kind of risk intelligence to also gauge how credible, trustworthy people are. That applies to our colleagues at work. It applies to our partners, you know, how reliable, sure, honey, I'll give you a call this evening, and then they never call. But it also applies in very serious questions of national security, you know, how much trust can we put on this intelligence source? There's a guy who says Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. How reliable is he? Should we believe him? So, you know, this is something that we have to a skill we all have to develop in both our personal and our professional lives.
But in the professional life, you know, it's sometimes, you know, some of these lapses become mission critical, but there's nothing you can really do about that. You know, there's nobody to complain to. You have to adjust. You have to do as you say.
And this is part of risk intelligence involves sort of learning that this is true. You just have to factor that probability into your decision, and there is ultimately no one else to. If your decision is wrong, you know, sometimes what you can do is make the best shot, and there's no guarantee. I like, you know, like Clint Eastwood in the Rookie. There's a great bit where he says, if you want a guarantee, buy a toaster.
Oh, I love that. I thought it was a washing machine, but I love that. Well, I wanted to say, actually, that I think that you look for workarounds with those unreliable people. And sometimes it's not that they're bad people. They're busy, and they get overwhelmed. And I realize that with people reading. And I found I never put, as you say, Dylan, in your wonderful book, Risk Intelligence. I'm talking with Dylan Evans, and his book is Risk Intelligence and How to Live with Uncertainty. Sorry, I covered up with a piece of paper. But I had this acquaintance, I'll call her, because she wasn't really a friend. And we had the same profession, and so it was good for us to get together, but she was really unreliable. And so what made it really comfortable for me to get together with her was actually admitting, now I put a calculation just now on a piece of paper, chance cancel, 50%, 85% chance she'd be late. I didn't have those figures on her before, but I knew that about her, but decided, you know, in the trade-off of things, it's worth more to me to be able to get together with her, you know, and I'll just bring a book or have something else to do because she's a really unreliable person, really unreliable as in 50%, you know, chance of cancellation.
Right. So you figured out that you, as you say, you felt more comfortable with that because you had made a conscious decision to, you know, you figured out how much you liked being with that person, how much you got annoyed when she was late, what the probability of her being late was, and you made a bet. And
yeah,
that's the way I encourage people to think about these decisions, is that, you know, this is not just a trivial metaphor, it's quite a deep metaphor that goes to the heart of decision theory, because even say von Neumann and Morgenstern, who are the great, who wrote the Bible of decision theory in the 1944 book on the theory of games and economic behavior, they essentially cast every decision as a decision on whether or not to gamble. Every decision we make can be analyzed as a kind of wager we make, a bet on whether something will happen or not. And I think that's quite, it can help us to think in that way, unless it is we just have some utter abhorrence of gambling. But then we've got to figure out, well, why is that? You know, is what's going on there? Is that because we, again, are really afraid of uncertainty? You know, I think it's something that people have to think about carefully.
I love the chapter. You have a great chapter in your book, Risk Intelligence, where you call gambling one of the best scientific tools we have for rational decision-making, because it's sort of bare. It's just the risk is right there in front of you, and what you're going to wager, and it's a really good tool, you say, to figure out, to sort of work on your risk intelligence.
Right. I mean, and this, you know, is not just, von Neumann and Morgenstern who picked this up, but it goes back to the very origins of decision theory back in the 17th century with Pascal and others. They'd lie in the analysis of optimal gambling behavior. And I think gambling, you know, it's got a bad press, especially in the States, actually. You know, in other countries, I live in Ireland now, and even though I'm British, I now live in Ireland. And Ireland, you know, the attitude towards gambling is very different. Gamblers can be national heroes in Ireland. It's a romantic kind of attitude to the luck of the Irish, I guess. But, you know, whichever your view of gambling as a sort of cultural phenomenon, I think if we strip that away and just see, well, what is the essence of a gambling game, you strip it down to its bare bones, you find that there's a decision you have to take between the status quo, which is I'm not going to gamble, and the decision to gamble, which can either lead to a payoff which is better than the status quo, or it can lead to a loss. And there's some uncertainty about which of those will happen that you can quantify. Now, those elements, that's essentially the elements of any decision that we have to take. So we can see any decision through the prism of gambling, and therefore we can use the tools that have been developed by mathematicians over the centuries to analyze gambling games, to analyze almost any decision in our lives.
And you say, one thing that you say is characteristic of expert gamblers is that they all knew their strengths and weaknesses very well. They were brutally honest, and that they kept detailed records of wins and losses and reviewed their strategies. And that was like what you were telling Greg, this thing of, okay, you know, start to rate people on their reliability. And if you do that, you can actually make a pretty educated guess on how trustworthy somebody is.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is one of the fun parts of doing research for this book, was that when I was trying to build up a picture of what people with high risk intelligence were like, did they have anything in common, did they think in similar ways, one of the parts of that research involved going around the world talking to some of the world's most successful gamblers. And when I say successful, I mean these are people who regularly, every year, they make at least a few million dollars, sometimes a lot more than that. So, you know, it's not luck. If you're making that sort of money year in, year out, it's skill. And, you know, they might be up or down a few hundred thousand dollars one week to the next, but over the course of a year, they would never make a loss. And these people did have some very interesting things in common. And one of the most important qualities, as you say, is that their ability to know their own limits, to know when they were out of their depth, and therefore to know when not to bet.
And now there's also a fascinating case of this in your book that you write about, which is not about a gambler who's gambling money. It's the case Hannah's Choice, about a girl who was told she needed a heart transplant or she died, and this is a very young girl.
Right. Yeah. This was a heartrending story in the UK when a few years ago a young girl refused a heart transplant, which could have possibly saved her life because she just didn't want to go through the pain of having, you know, an operation which might not work and which would then maybe lead to her being in hospital, away from her parents, and maybe dying alone and in pain. Now, this sounds like a crazy decision at first, but as she herself said, you know, she wasn't a normal 13-year-old girl. She'd been living with her illness for many years, and as a result, and with many, you see this in lots of children, in almost every child who has a serious disease, they are wise beyond their years. They have to be deep thinkers. And, you know, from one perspective, you can see that her decision to refuse any further medical treatment could be seen as entirely rational. She'd rather just die at home with her parents than risk another painful operation that might not succeed. Actually, there's a happy ending to this story because Hannah's chance of, when she analyzed, let's say she was analyzing this as a gamble, should she gamble on having the operation or not, one of the key variables she had to take into account, of course, was what's her chance of winning? What's her chance of going through the operation and having a successful outcome? Well, at first, she estimated that as relatively low, and that's why she decided not to go through with the operation. But then when doctors reassessed her a few months later, they found that she was actually getting slightly stronger and that her chances of having a successful operation had therefore improved. So she changed her mind, and she went through the operation, and it worked out. And so, thankfully, Hannah today, you know, is actually alive and well and has is having a much more normal life. So her heart transplant could add 25 years to her life. So, you know, that's a good example. Both of those decisions, both the decision, first one, not to have the operation, and then she changed her mind when the facts changed, meant that she was exercising very good risk intelligence at both occasions.
Really getting good facts is important. You talk about garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you have garbage, quote unquote, facts, you're going to have a problem with your predictions. But I want to talk a little more about that and too much certainty. But I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. I'm talking with Dr. Dylan Evans, who wrote the excellent book that I recommend, Risk Intelligence: How to Live with Uncertainty. So, With the too much certainty, I love this. You talk about the CSI effect, which is this misleading idea we have of how crimes are solved. And I just have to give you an example from my own life. My landlord, I mean, this is so ridiculous about the LAPD, not really a CSI effect. When someone tried to break into my house, told me to be sure the police got fingerprints. You know, I was lucky the police came, you know. But we have a very misleading idea of how the whole fingerprinting thing works, and you call fingerprint analysis a fundamentally subjective process.
Yeah, well, this is something that many people don't realize, that they think that, you know, if you've got some, I mean, and part of it is because people watch programs like CSI, where the evidence is almost always portrayed as decisive. But in fact, you know, in real life, evidence is not so decisive. It's much more uncertain and ambiguous, and therefore when people go to court, witnesses, juries, for example, if they've seen CSI, then, and they compare it with what they're seeing in the courtroom, what they see in front of them in the real-life court case is disappointing. So they may think that because it hasn't lived up to the standards of proof they've seen in CSI, it's not evidence. But this is, you know, this is actually problematic because it means they're more likely to acquit when they shouldn't. So, take fingerprints, for example. People don't realize that when a mark is found at the crime scene, it has to be compared to a reference fingerprint, which is retrieved from police files or taken from a suspect. But none of these reproductions is perfect. There's always small variations that can creep in when a finger is inked or scanned and so on. And then, as you say, more fundamentally, it's a subjective process. So when fingerprint analysts are identifying distorted prints, they've got to choose which features of the print to pay attention to, which features to ignore, and even highly trained experts can be swayed by outside information and miss certain points which might turn out to be crucial. So there's a subjective part in this whole process, but this tends to be ignored in court cases, and most jurors don't really understand it. So I think people need to. This can mean that the integrity sometimes of our legal system and court system is not what it should be.
And in fact, there was a horrible case. You wrote about this, the McKee case, the Scottish policewoman Shirley McKee, and the fingerprint at the murder scene.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is a tragic story. She was a very successful Scottish policewoman. But she was accused of leaving her fingerprint at a crime scene and then lying about it. It was a complete mistake, it turned out. But because the forensic team had made the identification, and because fingerprint evidence at the time was regarded as pretty much the gold standard, then she was convicted and she was... Eventually, she was actually found that the two U.S. fingerprint experts came to her help, and they concluded that the fingerprints didn't match. Not only that, they argued that the mistake couldn't have been an honest one, and in fact, there was some kind of cover-up involved. But she was declared innocent, but she only received a formal apology just last, I think actually even this year, that was 13 years after the event, and her whole career was ruined.
That's really horrible. There's so much I still want to get to. We don't have too much time left, just 10 more minutes. I wanted to talk, if I can get to it, about experts and how you also talk about how people tend to put more emphasis than they should on the strength of evidence and not enough on its credibility. And it's really important to look at whether evidence is credible, and we tend not to do that.
Yeah, so a good example might be when we look, maybe we've got an interview, some select people for a job, and we've got a whole bunch of reference letters, and we come across one reference letter, which is really glowing reference letter. It's, this person is one of the best people I've ever worked with, and this we're really impressed by how strong this evidence is. But what we maybe fail to take into account is the fact that this letter is written by someone who's only known the person they're talking about for maybe a couple of months. So the evidence is strongly in favor of the candidate, but the evidence is not really that credible, or the person who's writing it, their credibility is much lower than it would be if, let's say, they'd known the applicant for 5 or 10 years. And we say, okay, right, I'm going to take this into account, but we never take it into account sufficiently. And so this is just another one of these well-known cognitive biases that we've got to take into account and be aware of when we're trying to make decisions under uncertainty.
And you say that purposely considering a contradicting belief seems to improve your risk intelligence, and not just in the moment, but in general. So you're exposing yourself to the other side purposely.
Right, yeah. This is a good way of counteracting another well-known bias, which is called confirmation bias. And this is the tendency we all have to look for evidence that supports the view we already have. So... you know, we're always kind of finding things that seem to confirm what we already thought, but we rarely pay attention to, and still less do we actively seek out information that might undermine or contradict or disprove our beliefs. And if you think about it, that's not a very rational thing to do. It's obviously much more nicer to find evidence that we arrive, but so one thing that people have found as a very powerful way to increase risk intelligence is to consider, actively seek out and consider possible reasons why you might be wrong. This is a difficult thing for people to do. It doesn't come naturally at all, but it's one of the best disciplines for improving risk intelligence.
And actually, there's something wonderful that's been happening on YouTube from both sides, where they'll go ask some people who are voting a certain way and say, oh, the other guy believes in all this stuff, but it's actually stuff their candidate believes in. And that's an interesting way, I think, to illustrate to people what you're saying, how much we have a propensity for confirmation bias.
Right. I mean, you know, politics is a great way to examine all these biases. And, you know, presidential elections couldn't be a better time of the year to start applying some of this. You know, but you can see this in some of the most, you know, even in trivial things when, you know, the people, you know, it's, for example, how many people who vote for Obama really like Michelle Obama's clothes? They love them. And how many people who don't vote for Obama, who vote for, want to vote for Mitt Romney, like Michelle Obama's clothes? A lot fewer, strangely. It shouldn't make any difference, you know, what clothes Michelle Obama wears, right? It does,
right.
But, you know, you should, if you want to judge whether Michelle Obama's clothes are good-looking clothes or not, you should be judging them on the basis of their sartorial elegance, not on the basis of your – they should have no relationship to your political views. But clearly they do, because, you know, people – yeah, it's so funny how many people who vote – you know, the people who vote for Obama have a different view on who won the presidential debate, the second and the third one, to the people who vote for Romney. You know, we shouldn't – it shouldn't make any difference. We should be judging these things impartially, but, of course, very few people do.
But again, recognizing our lack of impartiality is helpful. And also, if people could do what I do, you know, and follow both sides on Twitter and on Facebook, you really start to see these patterns. And it's so funny because I really, you're making me feel better about myself because I do a lot of stuff on the science, dietary science, and I have a bunch of guests on the show. And Michelle Obama is just an idiot on all this stuff. I know she means well and everything. But I separate that from the fact that I think she dresses fabulously, you know, because I try to be honest about things. I know that my tendency is to think like, oh, she dresses like a hag, but she doesn't. She's great.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, I think, you know, we can apply this across the spectrum. And, you know, we just because, you know, we don't agree with Mitt Romney, for example, doesn't mean we have to think everything he says is a lie. You know, you know, this is the tendency to assume that people we disagree with are bad people rather than, you know, just honestly, you know, trying to grow up for solutions that might be different to the ones that we've found. You know, then I think that, you know, we can maybe move beyond this sort of very kind of groupish kind of thinking, which is sort of a remnant, I think, of our primate ancestry.
Now, a big problem is that we aren't comfortable with uncertainty, and I'm wondering if you can just, we're almost out of time, just give some advice on getting more comfortable with it so we don't feel so compelled to nail things down when we really don't have anything to nail down.
Well, I think, you know, one way to think is just to look at yourself when you're grasping for a decision. Are you saying, well, why am I so desperate for a decision now? What would I really want to believe something false just because it's clearer? Or, you know, is that really what I want to do? And why does it make me, you know, uncertain? Why does it make me nervous that I don't know everything? But yeah, that's just the world we live in. You know, get used to it.
Well, I do this in my own work that I've realized that when I can't get a paragraph written, it's because I haven't done enough research. And I sort of try to remind myself, but, you know, you still, every week I'm writing and I'm insecure again. Even though I wrote my column last week and I thought it was good at the end and everything, it is sort of hard to remember those things. But to remind yourself that it's hard to remember them maybe is a bit of a help.
Sure. I mean, you know, then, but, you know, there's this phenomenon in psychology called the imposter syndrome, you know, where we all think that, you know, like there are some real people out there who know what they're talking about or who really are qualified for their job, but I'm not really qualified. I don't really know what I'm talking about. I'm a fraud. But the thing is, everybody's a fraud.
Right.
Right. Everybody. It has uncertain, incomplete knowledge. Sure, some people know more than other people about some things, but we're all really you know, swimming in a sea of doubt and uncertainty and making the best we can out of the limited information we have available. So, you know, no one is omniscient. So, hey, you know, we're all swimming around in the same sea. So don't worry. You know, if you feel a fraud, well, so does everybody else.
Actually, you know, it was great for me. I got I was in my little cafe writing, and I got an email saying, "Can you be in Hollywood? This is like 11:30. Can you be in Hollywood at 1 to be on Dr. Drew?" And I said, "Yeah." And I'm an over planner, so I always, you know, I'll look up 6,000 things, you know, before I'm on TV. I had like 20 minutes, and I wrote down, I knew the stuff, but, you know, I didn't have the confidence usually when I'm on TV, you know, but I was on TV. I wasn't a big ass. They thought I was really good. And, you know, it's just that thing of feeling that way that gets you to, I think, do a lot of overwork.
Yeah, right. So I guess being comfortable with uncertainty is also about realizing that, you know, we will, it's just having that sometimes that the taking the chance and winging it.
Yeah, it's and having the guts to do that and remembering the times the chance came out well.
Exactly, and then if it doesn't come out well, look, sometimes you can do all the preparation in the world and it still won't come out well. So you're never going to get a guarantee. What you can do is try. You know, in fact, don't try too hard to make it perfect, because the more effort you put into that, the less effort you'll have to make something else good. So spread the effort around a bit and give everything a shot. And in the long run, hopefully you'll get more wins than losses. That's the way a gambler thinks.
I love that. And I love how at the end of your book you also say, you know, look, there's a chance you could have bad luck. It could all go down the toilet.
Exactly. So just accept that that's part of life. And, you know, sometimes, as Damon Runyon quote at the end of the book is one of my favorites. So he says, you know, the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle always to the strong, but that's the way to bet.
Oh, I love that. That's a great ending. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. I've been talking with Dr. Dylan Evans. He wrote a wonderful book I recommend, Risk Intelligence, How to Live with Uncertainty. Dylan, thank you. That was a really exciting, brain candy-filled show.
Thanks for having me on the show, Amy, and really enjoyed it, too.
You're 3,000 feet above the trees in a hot air balloon. Your significant other gets down on one knee and pulls out a box containing a ring. You realize that this is the magic moment you've been looking forward to. Because there's never been a better time to test drive the 2019 CLA Coupe at your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer. With its sleek silhouette, unrivaled performance and technology, the CLA is your dream ride. Visit mbusa.com/CLA to learn more. Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing. You're 3,000 feet above the trees in a hot air balloon. Your significant other gets down on one knee and pulls out a box containing a ring. You realize that this is the magic moment you've been looking forward to. Because there's never been a better time to test drive the 2019 CLA Coupe at your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer. With its sleek silhouette, unrivaled performance and technology, the CLA is your dream ride. Visit mbusa.com/CLA to learn more. Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing.